to episode 30 of Our Baseball Weekly, the weekly podcast from the baseball subreddit. This week, we have Rob and Hack back to recap how each team did in the MLB amateur draft this past week. Before we get to that, though, my name is Naim, and I am joined by Martin today to go over some of the highlights of the All-Star festivities and news from this weekend of baseball. Martin, how are you doing today?
Better than I was around the first inning of today's Mets game.
And you know what? Mets gonna Met, and then Pirates gonna Pirate.
Yeah, but this was coming after they lost. They blew a 6-0 lead in the last two innings last night, which was brutal. So I'm very glad they were able to salvage this one today.
Well, and especially on the day that DeGrom was supposed to start before going on the injured list, which is just a recurring nightmare for you, I presume.
Oh, yeah, it's terrifying.
But yeah. For all of baseball, to be honest, it sucks when Jacob DeGrom gets injured. He's so good and so fun to watch.
Yeah. But as I understand it, you have not seen the new worst play in Mets history, or that's what I'm calling it.
Yep. You told me to hold this off until the show, so I'm going to hit play now, and I'm going to give you my play-by-play. So now here's the swinging bunt, and there goes the... Oh, he just kicked the ball to the dugout, but it didn't go all the way. They just stopped. They thought it went to the dugout. They just stopped moving. What is happening? Oh, my God. This is incredible. He made it to second base on a swinging bunt because they just stopped playing baseball because they thought the ball went into the dugout. Oh, my God.
So... what happened was...
Taiwan Walker is pissed. Oh, there's Rob's about to get ejected. Yep, there he goes. Oh my God, this is great. Okay.
So as I understand it, what happened was Walker thought the ball had rolled foul when he swiped it away.
Okay.
And it hadn't rolled foul yet, or it had rolled back into fair territory in the split second before he hit it. And... the Pirates broadcast picked it up immediately. You can hear them yell, "That's a fair ball!" Right as he knocks the ball away, and realize that...
You still can't stop making the play.
Havoc is about to happen.
You've got to make the play. I thought that it looked to me like they thought the ball went into the dugout and he made a two-base error, and that's why they stopped playing. But he thought he knocked the ball foul. You got to keep playing
right.
The game.
He thought it was a foul ball, strike two.
Yeah.
And Mets fans, there was a play in, I want to say, 1990, where David Cone argued a call with an umpire while the runners circled the bases that was similar to that in terms of just the general vibe. And for Yankee heads, there was that play with Chuck Knobloch in one of their championship years. But this is just one of the more... kind of explicable but awful plays I've ever seen.
This is like end of the decade, worst plays of the decade material. Yeah.
Yeah, this is...
It's like
world of sports 2030.
Like that classic Astros 2011, 2012 play was Astros Nats, and they made four errors on the same play to let Kurt Suzuki get to third base on an infield hit. It feels like that to me.
And the Pirates, who were on the other side of a different horribly dumb play earlier in this season, Will Craig, the Pirates first baseman, who is now, I believe, in the KBO. I hope someone shows this to him and says, "It's not just you." Because he's off the hook.
Clearly. All right, moving on, a little bit of other Mets news, a thing for the Mets to be happy about. Pete Alonso won the Home Run Derby. As a Mets fan, Martin, I'm sure you were rooting along with the rest of us for Pete Alonso.
Yes, and I was definitely rooting for Ohtani to make it past the first round, but I'm thrilled that Alonso got to repeat.
And for what it's worth, I don't know who put it in our show notes. I presume it was Lewis who put in the show notes that he did call last week that Alonso was going to win, and then he was going to win pretty much exactly the way that he did win. So if you want to go back and listen to that on last week's episode, the timestamp is there for you to listen to. But yes, very much so, Lewis did predict this exact win for Alonso. But about Ohtani, you know, like, I also would have loved to see Ohtani get past the first round, but the way he got knocked out is like, that was almost... The first round of the Home Run Derby this year was almost the best round. Like, first of all, Alonso hit 35 home runs, and then Salvador Perez, poor Salvador Perez, hit 28 home runs in the first round and didn't advance because he had to face the Alonso train.
Yeah, I still do not understand why they do individual matchups for this, for the first round.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's for that exact reason. I get that. I see where you're coming from, but I think it's just like, it's to make it like, to give you more of a, like, a head to head just feels like, okay, now I know that, like, immediately I know that, that Perez has to beat Alonso, right? So that's an immediacy. Whereas, like, if you're doing, like, you know, like if you're doing like an Olympic thing where you see like them do heats for qualifying, it's like, okay, well, until the first four people go, I don't know what the fifth guy needs to do. So like, it could be anything. So I think the immediacy factor is something to it. But I did see other people criticize sort of that same sort of thing. I think on Twitter somebody said it's like the ADD Home Run Derby. And as somebody with ADD, you know what? I get it. I maybe agree, but I think it's a good thing because it is so much more exciting than the Derby was in the old format, in my opinion.
I do have one other critique that kind of ties into what you were saying about ADD, in that they were never good at enforcing the baseball has to land before pitcher throws next pitch rule.
Right.
But this year they just seemed to give up on it entirely. So pitchers were just lobbing them in, not as quickly as they could, but quickly enough that the camera couldn't focus on, you know, the gigantic home runs being hit by Ohtani and Soto and Alonso and Trey Mancini, who
did a great job. My my favorite tweet from the night was quote, "It's Pete Alonso time," says Pete Alonso while watching an inspirational story for cancer survivors everywhere play out in front of his eyes. So like you watch Trey Mancini, who just recovered from colon cancer, about to have like an incredible night. You know, he plays for the Orioles, so it's not like he's gonna have many other incredible nights, and in comes Pete Alonso and just like, nah, I'm gonna whack some home runs, bro.
Yeah, there was a great sequence when they just showed him like bopping along to the music at one point. Someone else on Twitter like posted, "What a story, Trey Mancini. What a story, an inspiration, a legend. It is time for a man who has only had the opening riff from Immigrant Song going through his head for the past 2 hours to annihilate him."
I'll tell you what, man, it was electric, though.
It was perfect.
It was incredible. I want to touch back on the Ohtani Soto showdown, because like, it was, you know, like, the fact that they tied and then tied again, like, it was so cool to watch. Like, it was, I don't want to say it's incredible baseball because it's the Home Run Derby and it's not really baseball, but it was like, it was one of the coolest Home Run Derby moments.
It was great. It was great theater, because I remember 2 years ago, Vlad Guerrero and I think Jock Peterson in the semifinals had the same thing.
Yeah.
And I remember in both of these cases, it ended up tiring the guy who won out
pretty much,
and then giving Alonso a wide open like chance to win. So he's the vulture of home run derbies.
I mean, yeah, it sure worked out for Pete Alonso. A friend of mine in our Slack chat was saying that, like, you know, like, what an anticlimactic end, because Soto hit 3 of 3 in his three swings and Ohtani missed the first one. I'm like, yes, what an anticlimactic end to lose in double overtime. Like, what are you talking about? He went to double overtime and that's when he finally lost. Like, but yeah.
It was very fun.
I don't know. I think the Home Run Derby is more exciting than it's ever been in the last few years. I agree that maybe it would be not, maybe they should have a second camera to track like two home runs going out at once. But like, I don't care for them to stop. Like, gotta wait for the ball to land. Nah, just hit the dingers. Like,
yeah, I think it's more an issue with the camera work and the graphics overload.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Moving on from the Home Run Derby to the All-Star Game. So the American League takes, I believe, the 8th All-Star Game in a row. They just won, keep winning All-Star Games.
I think dating back to like 2002 or 2003, after they tried the new rule, the AL was like, is like 16-3 or something, where they only lost 2010 through 2012, and they've won like every other game.
Yes, that is correct. They have won every one since 97, aside from the tie, and then 2010 through 2012.
So nationally, get your something together.
Yeah, get your act together. I don't know. I mean, you know, it was at Coors Field, so we did see a towering home run in the All-Star Game, aside from just the towering home runs we saw at the Home Run Derby.
We also got some mic'd up moments that were mostly not very fun, but Liam Hendricks cursing on air made it all worth it.
Liam Hendricks, because I think he wasn't getting the voices back in his ear.
I really hope he was like just pretending. Oh, I can't hear you.
I liked some of the mic'd up moments. Like Freddie Freeman mic'd up was pretty fun. You know, joking around about the fact that he's 6'5" and Aaron Judge getting on base makes him look short.
Right.
It's a fun moment. I don't know. I like, if you're gonna do it anywhere, then at least the All-Star Game doesn't matter, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's better than doing it in the playoffs and sticking Ramon Laureano with it, you know?
Yes. Oh my God, I just remembered that.
But yes, Vlad Guerrero Jr. With the towering home run, the 200th home run, by the way, in All-Star Game history, went home with the All-Star Game MVP. So good for Vlad Guerrero Jr. He's fun to watch.
He's becoming the superstar that was promised.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Here's a really dumb joke that I half saw and half thought of. What is the Toronto Blue Jays' favorite movie?
Junior.
No, it's Fast and Furious, because they're all about family. All right, that was because they got Kevan Biggio too, and he's not a junior.
I hope I've inspired at least one person to look up the movie Junior now and ruin their entire day.
Hey, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito had a great partnership in the 90s. All right, let's talk about, I did not see this article, but apparently Rob Manfred says that the current plan is to get rid of the 7-inning doubleheaders and the runner on second rule after the 2021 season. Now, I think I speak for most baseball fans when I say good, because I think the 7-inning doubleheader especially, I think, is bad. I also don't like the runner on second rule, but I like the 7-inning doubleheader less. They're both bad. Let's be clear here.
I don't like the 7-inning doubleheaders, but I kind of enjoy the zippiness of the games, or it's like kind of, it's an interesting like change, but the runner on second is just like completely anathema to baseball.
So I agree with that, but like again, so like on the other hand, so I think the 7-inning doubleheaders is anathema to baseball, right? Because it's 7 innings, it's a 9-inning game. You should be playing all 9 innings, right? Whereas the runner on second rule, I agree. I also don't like it, and I think it also is it doesn't feel right, and I don't think it should happen. However, at least it gives you like a chance to you know, end like long extra inning games earlier. You know, I get it. I love watching 18 inning games, but it's terrible for the players. They hate it. And especially like if you live in New York and you're watching your team in San Francisco, like play an 18 inning game, like that game's not over till 3 a.m, you know, like the Cardinals have twice in the last like 10 years played like 16, 17 and 18 inning games in Arizona, and those games run to like 2, 3 a.m.
16 or 17 in a game in San Francisco in 19.
Yeah, so like it's, you know, like I hate that one slightly less, but I do hate both of them a lot. Now some people think that it might just be MLB posturing because MLBPA might want these rules to continue because, like I said, it does protect the players if they play fewer innings. But I don't know, it just doesn't feel right.
No, not at all. But here's hoping things get back to normal.
In the same interview, Manfred said the DH and NL now qualifies as a non-radical change. So, I mean, I think we all sort of know it's coming soon. Also not a fan, but I guess we're going to have to get used to it sooner than later.
That one's been sort of in the works for a few years, so it's less jarring.
Right, yeah, it's not jarring, but it's still disappointing, to say the least.
Right, I like watching pitchers hit, and I like, to an extent, that break your pitcher gets when the opposing pitcher comes up.
Yeah.
But you don't want pitchers getting hurt, that's...
Right, and I agree, right? You definitely don't want pitchers getting hurt. And for example, the Cardinals' Carlos Martinez just before the All-Star break ended up on the 60-day DL because he hurt his thumb on a swing, you know? And like that sucks. That totally blows, especially as he was sort of starting to get his stride. And I think, did DeGrom hurt himself on a swing earlier this year too?
I think he's had a couple of swing-related injuries. The most recent thing he said isn't on a swing, which I don't know if that's good or horrible, but he's had at least a couple of minor injuries in his career from swings.
Yeah, so I
and
agree.
And he still goes up hacking like 100% every time because he's so hyper-competitive.
Right, exactly, yeah. All right, well, let's move on to a couple of quick notes. First of all, today, as we're recording on Sunday, Alex Reyes now holds the record for most consecutive saves to start a career. So he has 24 saves in 24 save opportunities now. He passed LaTroy Hawkins for that record.
And this streak actually goes back to 2016 when he was a fresh-faced prospect.
Yeah, sure does. Which is, I knew he had done some relief appearances in 2016, but I didn't realize that he picked up a save back then. Yeah, and then obviously, you know, if you're familiar with Alex Reyes' history, he spent a lot of time on and off the IL over the last, you know, 2013 is when he joined the organization. So yeah, over the last several years, he certainly spent his time on the IL. He also has a walk rate of like 45%. He has a 7 BB per nine, according to Baseball Reference, and 4.9 hits per nine. Like he's just. I don't know, man. He doesn't give up that many runs. He's got a 1.49 ERA. It's kind of bonkers that he's managed
to. He's got a 1.32 WHIP.
Yeah, yeah, like, a 1.32 WHIP and a one point. His WHIP is almost the same as his ERA. It's incredible.
That could actually happen. Like if that happens.
It certainly could because he did allow two base runners today and didn't allow any runs. So I don't know what it's at as of today, but it's actually inching closer and closer to one another.
Beautiful.
It's beautiful. But you know what? He gets the save. So what can you say? let me see. As of today, his ERA is now 1.45. I don't think it shows his WHIP on FanGraphs day-to-day.
I do not see it. I see 3.66 FIP, 4.65 XFIP.
and a 1.45 ERA. You know what? The results matter. That's
yeah,
all I'm saying.
This is a thought experiment. This is like what happens if the character from Major League, or what happens if someone throws 108 but doesn't know where the ball is going.
1.34 WHIP, according to my rudimentary calculations, by adding walks and hits and dividing them by innings pitched. What a world.
Iron, airtight.
He has 35 walks in 43 innings. He gave up two more walks today. It's somebody on Twitter, I think it might have even been Grant Brisby, said, like, if you took this player and put him in a video game and took the stats back, you would get sent back and told to, like, fix your code because it's too unrealistic.
Right.
It's unbelievable, but he's doing great. Also, just a quick note, there's not really much more we have to the story, but yesterday on Saturday, as we're recording, there was a shooting outside of Nationals Park. Now, as far as we know, it wasn't game related in any way. It just happened to be outside the park. Three people were injured, but as far as we know, they're all going to make a full recovery. They called the game. It was the Padres at Nats, and
because the noise was so close, there was a bit of a panic at first. And there was a very nice story in the Washington Post about Davey Martinez, the Nationals manager. When fans who were like making their way through the tunnels and or through the clubhouse area of the stadium, I guess just getting lost in the way out, but they found themselves near the Nats team offices and security asked, like, are you guys family of the players? And Davey Martinez basically said, they're family, they're our fans, which he seems like a really great person.
Yeah.
Tatis and Machado were apparently instrumental in escorting, I'm not sure the number, but escorting some fans into the dugout for safety.
Right. Jace Tingler sort of said the same thing. So Tatis didn't have any of his actual family in the stands, but he basically said, yeah, they're on our team, they're family, and escorted a lot of people into the dugout where they thought would be the safest place. So it is, you know, there were some, obviously some nice stories from the players. As far as we know, nobody's injured. I think they're still looking for the shooter. I mean, the people are injured, but as far as we know, they're going to make a full recovery. They're looking for the shooter still, but didn't appear to be baseball related. It was outside of the park. I think it was like outside the right field gates, and they let people exit through left and center field. But yeah, it was there was a scary few minutes that we you know, that everybody sort of was like, what the hell's going on at Nats Park?
Yeah, that was a scary bit.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that does it for the week in news. Martin, thanks so much for joining me.
Anytime. Happy to be back. I haven't been on in a while, so I'm happy to be back for a big week in news.
Yeah, nice big week, All-Star week.
Fortunately,
we have a nice long segment with Rob and Hack recapping the MLB amateur draft. So we'll kick it over to Rob and Hack.
Welcome to the draft recap. I am Hack. I am joined by Rob, aka Derp. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good. I enjoyed the All-Star game, getting to see, you know, Shohei Ohtani, both the hit and pitch, Jared Walsh make a good play. So it was a home run derby was good too. So yeah, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. There wasn't a ton for the Cardinals. It was the Nolan Arenado show. That was kind of it. And I was glad to see him smiling and, you know, just giving the Denver fans kind of what they deserve at this point. And it's a chance to cheer on the guy they've had for years. So again, we're going over the draft. We're going to recap everything. How we're going to kind of do this is we're going to start off with some overall just draft strategy and kind of just general information about how teams typically go about things. And then we're going to go through picks. We're going to go through team by team. So if you're a Pirates fan, you're going to be out on this podcast real early on, because we're going to go through your picks first, and then you will not care about what happens with the Reds or the Cardinals or anybody else, and you can tune out. But from there, we'll just go team by team. So, first of all, let's go over how you kind of saw this draft play out, so to speak. So whether it be college players first, high school players first, et cetera. And then we'll go into kind of what different decision-making is happening there.
Yeah. So, I mean, this draft was really defined by pitching, lots of pitching, especially early on. You know, teams obviously prefer to take bats in general, especially early on the draft. And, you know, we saw plenty of, you know, college bats and high school bats going throughout the first couple of rounds. But overall, I would say the draft was defined by lots of pitching being picked. You know, we'll get into a couple of teams that went really overkill, you know, or that we might see. But overall, I think it's just more, you know, teams kind of shifting to a lot of analytical models that really push, you know, certain performers. And when you have not as much data because of, you know, basically a lost 2020 season, you're going to see teams kind of going towards pitchers, especially collegiate pitchers, just because they have a little bit more trust in the data that they're able to get on them.
Cool. So I think the next thing is to go over some of the terms we'll be talking about. And one big one that we kind of discussed before we started recording was overslot and underslot. And I think it's important for the listeners to know what we mean by that, and really like what teams are trying to achieve when we say, oh, they took someone over slot, they took someone under slot.
Right. Yeah. So a couple of years ago, more than a couple of years ago, really at this point, MLB was trying to essentially cut down on the amount of spending that teams were doing in the draft. And really it was more about the spending inflation. And so they went to kind of a hard cap system where through the first 10 rounds, teams are basically given a total pool, like a bonus pool of money that they're able to use. They can spread it out however they want. MLB has recommended slots. So, you know, for a certain pick, it might be, you know, 2 million, 5 million, you know, 750,000. It kind of just depends. They do the slot. And so if you're a team with more than 10 picks, so like the Cincinnati Reds, who were picking more in the middle of the draft, they had a pretty big bonus pool. So when it comes to slotting, overslot, underslot is, you know, you could think of it shorthand as if it's overslot, then it's usually, okay, well, this slot is 2 million and they're going to give this player 3 million. It's overslot. If it's a 2 million slot and they're going to give that player 1 million, then it's underslot. Now what teams are trying to do is if they go underslot early on, generally it's because they're trying to get an overslot player later. So if they're picking and say the slot is $5 million and they pick a player who's only looking for $4 million, they're going to take that $1 million savings. And, you know, say later on, they have another pick with a $1 million pool. They're going to give it to a player, you know, maybe a high school player who's asking for $2 million. So the idea there is maybe you don't get the actual best player on the board, but you get two prospects that in total are better if you just kind of went straight down the middle and just said, okay, we're going to pick the best player here and then the best player later on based on slot. Because that's the other thing is if you go over slot in comparison early on, that likely means you're going to have to go under later. And some teams will go especially under, and that means picking college seniors. Those guys tend to sign for, you know, pretty much the minimum draft amount or not that much above in the, you know, unless they're like a pretty high end senior prospect, which you'll get a few of those. But what you're looking for really is teams kind of mixing and matching those two way, you know, the two underslot and overslot to kind of end up something a little bit better than the sum of just going straight, okay, down the board slot value.
So that you kind of hit on my next question and point at the end there is like how are teams manipulating this to sign players for cheaper, or why are they ordering people the way they are? And it's like you said, it's mostly just to kind of corner or not. Maybe that's not the right word, but it's basically to say like, hey, like we know these people require more money and this other player may not have another option. And right. That they have to sign with us or they don't play. Like it's kind of
I mean, the, you know, to kind of give a little bit of a kind of a maybe a little bit further detailed breakdown is, you know, say you're a team that's picking fifth overall, and then your next pick is not until 35th overall. What you might do at pick number five is instead of picking, you know, if say one through four, the number one through four prospects go in front of you, instead of picking the fifth best player, you might pick the 10th best player. But by picking that player, you know, so at your next pick at 35, you might be able to take the 15th or 20th best player. And so what teams are looking for is instead of the 35th best player in the fifth, they might prefer to go with trying to get those, the pairing of the, you know, the underslot and the overslot player. So that's right. Kind of where what they're looking for. You're also going to find some teams that are also trying to, you know, use the slotting system, and also with how they're focusing on models and certain players who maybe fit into a better model as well.
Cool. So I think that's like a good amount of like color around everything. So let's get into team by team, pick by pick. And so we're going to lead it off the Pirates, and Henry Davis is our 1-1 pick, our first overall.
Yep. And so we get to talk about the underslot and overslot right away. And, you know, for those of you who may not have listened to our podcast a couple weeks ago with Keenan Lamb, highly recommended in terms of scouting breakdowns for some of these top players. But Henry Davis is the number one college player, and usually the number one college player does go in the first couple of picks, or college hitter specifically. You know, last 2 years, the number one pick has been a college hitter. So this is third straight year, but he's underslot because in comparison to the previous two players, and that's Spencer Torkelson and Adley Rutschman, he is not a slam dunk number one. There are some people who viewed him as, you know, I think overall, most people would view him as a top 3 to 5 prospect in this draft. You know, maybe some are a little lighter. There, you could probably find occasional scout here and there who sees him as the best player in the draft. But Henry Davis is basically a college catcher who might not catch, but has a big, big bat and strong arm. You know, maybe in a corner, maybe if they go to an automatic strike zone, he's able to stay behind the plate. But what the Pirates did here is they basically were waiting the last second, trying to find a deal for who to go under slot on. And by going under slot on Davis, they were able to pick up Anthony Solomento, Lonnie White Jr., Bubba Chandler, and Owen Kellington with their next four picks. And Chandler and Solomento specifically are considered first round talents. So by going under slot here on Davis, the idea is basically to accumulate those extra first round talents. You know, maybe they didn't get the number one guy on their board, but they got a few of them. And then White is also a pretty good prospect. And Kellington, you know, was probably an underslot pick, but he also has some interesting aspects to him as well.
So obviously Henry Davis is, you know, the round one first pick of the next, you know, 2 to 8 picks, or around 2 through 10 picks. Is there someone that you would particularly be excited about over the others, or is it they've kind of gone in terms of importance in their eyes, that, you know, Solomonto is the next most exciting player of that round of that team? Or is there anyone else that you think would be like, hey, this is kind of a steal?
Yeah, I mean, Bubba Chandler is, you can kind of hear in our interview with Keenan Lamb a little bit more on him. But I mean, he was a commit to Clemson to play quarterback. He's a two-way player. You know, it's extremely exciting. He might not have been the quarterback, though, at Clemson. He may have had to change position. You know, he is athletic. So it's not like he was a lock to do that. Whereas, like, if he were a lock, it might actually make sense for him to go to college. But that is a pretty big get in round three, you know, along with Solomento, who is also a first round talent. So it's definitely, when you talk about trying to go underslot early to get overslot later, the Pirates basically nailed this, you know, assuming that everyone signs, which, you know, in the first 10 rounds, I would say assume that everyone is going to sign. Most of the time teams are talking to the players, they're going to hit the bonuses. It should be fine. So the first, that's how it kind of works in the first 10 rounds. But yeah, with this strategy, they pretty much nailed it to the best that you could do in terms of, you know, the underslot overslot mix. You know, there's some years and there's going to be some teams that we get to that they'll do this and just something goes wrong. Some player gets picked before they can get to them. You know, it just ends up not working out. Of course, you know, in a couple of years, if Davis is a corner player, the bat's not that great, and some of these high school guys, you know, don't pan out. Of course, you know, it might look wrong in hindsight, but I would say, you know, kind of post draft reaction, I would say the Pirates did about as well as you could, picking first overall in their pool, kind of what they did.
All right. Well, then draft grade for the Pirates is an A. And then we go to the next team on the list is the Rangers, who in terms of the big names in the draft got one of the biggest. And it was kind of one of those things that, like, if he falls to two, he's going to go two. So that starts with Jack Leiter. And how do you see the rest of their draft going from there?
Yeah, so I mean, Leiter, it was interesting. There were so many rumors about the Red Sox trying to basically, you know, try to get Jack Leiter to say, hey, you know, raise your bonus so you come down to us. And they're really pushing for that. And the Rangers, you know, popped Leiter. It seemed like they might go Jordan Lawler, who we'll talk about later, who's a local kid for them. But it seems like a good fit. You know, Leiter is one of the best players, you know, on the board, if not the best. And then from there, you kind of have to, you know, some of these guys, if you're going slot, like basically, you know, Leiter is arguably, you know, the number one, number two, maybe number three player on the board. If you're picking that kind of guy, you kind of have to play it pretty much chalk from there. But they still got Aaron Zavala in the second round, who he himself is a fairly solid prospect. So that's, you know, that's obviously a, you know, kind of good, but it's maybe not the biggest pick, you know, in the second round, but you kind of have to just kind of go that way. You know, I think with some of their other picks with Colley and Moeller and Brad, it's like, all right, these are solid prospects. There may be a slightly going earlier than you would expect based off kind of their pre-draft rankings. But, you know, when you're picking someone like Leiter and you're, you know, like I said, you're kind of going with the big guy off the board early, you basically kind of have to play it pretty straight there. I mean, they did pick Will Taylor in the 19th round. Will Taylor is a first round talent. And I mentioned that, you know, in the first 10 rounds, if someone gets picked, you can assume they sign. If a top, you know, 100, 150 prospect gets picked in the 11th round or later, it's the opposite. I would assume they don't sign. So someone like Taylor probably going to end up at college next year, but you know, it's not 0% odds. It just seems very unlikely.
Yeah. And especially once you get down to that far of a round, you're not going to get that same level of like bonus money. You're not going to get that same slot level money. And it's more of an incentive to get a free, you know, free education. So from there, we move on to the Tigers, who again are taking another, you know, high. I mean, they're high on the draft board once again after taking Torkelson last year, and they take Jackson. Did we decide it's Job or did we mispronounce it again?
Yeah, I believe it's Jackson Job.
Okay.
Yeah, so Job is the best high school pitching prospect in this class. Right-handed pitcher, you know, big time stuff. What's interesting about this pick is that Marcelo Meyer, who we'll get to with the next pick, sounded like he was the number one player on the Tigers board, but they didn't go with him despite him being available. It sounds like that the Tigers had a verbal deal with Job and kept the commitment, which I would say is fairly honorable. There's some teams in the league who I would assume would not honor that or would definitely take it down to the wire of whether they were going to honor that. So I can kind of give the Tigers a little bit of props there, but it's not like Job is a massive overreach. He is going to be under slot here. You know, that's kind of like when you come to a verbal deal, usually like for a player like that here at number three, it's going to be under slot. But what that let them do was get Ty Madden in the compensation round A. Ty Madden for some is, you know, a top 10 to 15 prospect in the draft, but there's just some teams that are kind of scared by the performance, kind of what it looked like, you know, what the kind of overall stuff played as, you know, there's, you know, teams are going deep into this stuff in terms of, you know, fastball plane, fastball spin, but you know, there's some years that it's like Madden could have stuck in the top 10 and they're getting him, you know, basically with their, you know, it's kind of like in between the first and second round. So, you know, 30 picks basically in deep to the draft. So someone like Madden is, you know, potentially going to be a steal there. And then in the second round, they got Isaac Pacquiao, who he himself is a really solid prospect. So in terms of, you know, guys who are or teams who are looking to kind of cut deals, you know, very quickly, we already got, you know, what's likely the second team. It's a, you know, pretty, I would say a pretty solid haul in terms of what they're able to work. Cause Jobe is, you know, he's getting picked third as an underslot, but he's still probably top, you know, 5 to 10 player. So it's not like he's, you know, he's like some, you know, massive reach where you're getting, you know, the 60th best player third overall. It's still good, you know, and you got Madden who is going to be solid pack. And then you got Pacquiao, Dylan Smith, their third rounder, is a pretty solid prospect himself. So overall, you know, this is a team that, you know, maybe I'm sure some people will still argue that going Meyer and making it work from there would have been the better route. But, you know, honoring that verbal agreement with Jobe seems to have worked out in terms of, you know, picking up a couple of big arms, some solid bats as well.
Absolutely. And then so a perfect segue to Marcelo Meyer and the Red Sox.
Yeah. So Marcelo Meyer was viewed as the number one player by a lot of people. Now, I'm not sure if it was a majority or, you know, if it was a majority, it might not have been a strong majority, because if he was, he probably would have stuck at, you know, maybe in the top three picks. But it's a high end talent, you know, shortstop in high school, and the Red Sox got to be happy. You know, they wanted lighter, but this is a great consolation prize. You know, it's funny with, you know, a team like the Red Sox who's picking so early in the draft, but is competing right now, and they're going to get, you know, potentially a impact talent this year. But not only do they get Meyer, but in the second round, they then take a chance on Judd Fabian, who has big, big tools coming out of the University of Florida, but is also a massive, massive risk when it comes to strikeouts. Another guy we talked about on our previous episode, but the comparison is to a former Vandy outfielder, Jaron Kendall. Dodgers picked in the late first round to get, or I think it was the late first round, might've been the second, but they gave him, you know, solid money to come out, and he had the same issues. So it's generally not great when college hitters are showing, you know, big strikeout rates. The reason why you're generally picking college hitters is because they've kind of smoothed some of those edges, but it's a nice upside play, especially, you know, picking, you know, able to get Meyer and to kind of put that on top. I think that's, you know, could be pretty special combination. You know, most of it's going to be on kind of how Meyer's able to perform, but he looks pretty legit. And from there, they kind of played it, you know, a little bit not safe, but you kind of have to, if you're going to take the best player on the board at number four, the slot value is, I think for their pick, is something like 6.6 million. Meyer might want based on that whole slot, or he might want more, you know, we'll kind of see. So from there, they kind of played it, you know, a little bit under slot, and that's just kind of how it goes if you're going to pick one of the top players at the top.
Yeah, and I think at the same time too, it's like it's such a weird, the MLB draft is always such a weird thing, you know. It's like, it's not like the NFL draft where you just take somebody good, like, and you find a place to put them. Like, you in the MLB draft, there's a lot more like, we're going to wait and see on this guy, we're going to try to develop this guy or whatever. Like, there's a lot of high ceiling, low floor kind of things. And
yeah. No, with Meyer, you could point to, say, like, you know, there's a lot of people who like him, have been comparing him to, I think Corey Seager was kind of one of the comps, but he's got to work to even stay at shortstop, you know, compare that to, you know, NFL, NBA, NHL, where some of these guys are coming in and are pretty much ready to go. You know, maybe they need some fine tuning, but there's, you know, we might not see Marcelo Meyer in the big leagues until, you know, 2024, 2025. You know, Judd Fabian, like I said, despite being a college player, is still going to need some work. I mean, even Jack Leiter, who might be, you know, the best prospect in the draft and is a college pitcher, there's a chance, you know, he doesn't pitch this year. Now, maybe if he'd gotten picked by the Red Sox, maybe they would have tried to run him up and get him into the bullpen to help in a stretch run this year. But, you know, someone like him is still going to need some time to even develop.
Yep, definitely. And so moving forward, before we get to my, I feel like this is the pick before the pick that I have a big question on. So we're going to go with the Orioles next. They pick at 5. And I'll let you kind of describe this one, but then I've got a big question for the D-backs.
Right. So with the Baltimore Orioles, they like to cut deals. They got Mike Elias, who came over from the Astros, and that seems to be his MO. as the, you know, the guy calling the shots. And so they took Colton Cowser, who's an outfielder from Sam Houston State. He's performed well in college, but Sam Houston State does not play against great competition. So it's hard to say. You know, apparently their models do like him, but this is a pick to definitely save money. The problem is, unlike the first couple of teams that we mentioned who took the underslot guy, they didn't really get someone to pop. You know, they didn't pick Colton Cowser and then get Bubba Chandler like the Pirates did. You know, they ended up with Connor Norby, who is himself a college hitter, and that's kind of not the trend. So then you go down to their next player is Reed Trimble, and it's another college hitter, and then John Rhodes, another college hitter. These are all good prospects. None of these are, you know, way off the board or anything like that, but there was never a time where you'd say, okay, the Orioles pick Colton Cowser or Connor Norby to save money to go get this guy. It was a lot of, this seems like a pick to save money, but if you keep doing that over and over, then what was, you know, why are you kind of reaching a little bit, you know, for some of these guys who might go under slot? It just seemed like a very weird combination. You know, they went very heavy in terms of college hitters all throughout. Like I said, they're very model driven. So that's not too much of a surprise. The surprise is more just like, okay, you get Colton Cowser, you know, where's the big pop of, you know, they could have gone Will Taylor, who I mentioned earlier, who, you know, ended up going way late in the draft. And, you know, if you pick him in the second round, maybe it could be just that the money's not there. You know, that might be the case. But when you see other teams doing the underslot early, like the Orioles, and then the Orioles don't come away with, you know, kind of like an additional first round talent, it is very perplexing. But, you know, teams have more information, or at least they have their proprietary information and they're trusting it. So we'll kind of have to wait and see on this, but I found it to be a very odd draft, not maybe a bad one, you know, where it just kind of like, I can't believe they took him, but very, you know, strange in comparison to some of these other underslot teams.
So I think I have one question on the Orioles draft is, do you think at this point, Dante Williams is someone they expect to actually sign, or do you think that they're maybe 50-50 on him? Because as someone who has watched him play, I'm trying to think of the right way to put it there. I think there's a lot of like untapped, like maybe not untapped, but I feel like there's a lot of potential with Dante Williams, and that round four is not high enough. And maybe, you know, maybe he's just going to be like, hey, this is my chance. I'm going to go do it in Baltimore. And that's his decision, his prerogative. But I feel like he's one of those people that could come back and be like, we'll go round two next year.
Yeah. Or round one. I think he's listed as a senior, but I think he kind of come back as like a COVID senior. Mm-hmm. It might be. So that's kind of that's another twist on this, is some of these players have got extra eligibility to play with, but I would assume he's signable. You know, that's kind of my thing is more that until a guy doesn't sign, I just assume they're signable if they're going in the first 10 rounds, because most of the time teams are doing their due diligence. But that would make their draft even more complexing, because then, you know, if a guy doesn't sign, you don't get to spread that money around. You lose right. that pit. You lose that slot's value. Mm-hmm. So, you know, his slot value is 549,000. So if they were to not sign him, it's not like they could go give that money to someone else. But then on top of that, it just, he's interesting. And I think it's just going to be very, like, you know, I've said a couple times, but model driven picks, you know, that's kind of where they're going. It just, you know, unless someone is able to kind of, you know, peek behind the curtain and see kind of what the model is picking up, it's kind of hard to judge, because I think in terms of consensus, they kind of reached on a little bit of every pick, which is usually fine. Like I said, if you're going to pop that overslot player, and they just didn't really do that. Whereas like Dante Williams, like he might go for underslot. And if that's five straight underslot picks potentially. So it gets very, you know, very intriguing. You know, maybe some of these are going to end up being slot picks and they just like them more. You know, sometimes teams just have a different preference than the consensus.
Yeah, and like I'm one of those people that I've seen Dante Williams play in person, and that guy's a gnat. So like he's like a David Eckstein, like he's annoying to watch. Like he's just there's no reason, like it seems like he's always like up to bat. He seems like he's always on base. He's just annoying. But we'll move on. We'll go to the Diamondbacks. And this is the one that I really had kind of a question on. And this is full disclosure. This is all intel from my mother. So Mama Hack had an issue with this one. Okay. And it's mostly because she thinks that, first of all, both of us are Cardinals fans, but we live in Arizona. And so we follow the Diamondbacks because we have to live here. We have to be around. And
the way you say that is like, we have to live here as if, like, you know,
I mean, it's like standing on the sun. It's the whole meme.
Yeah.
But Jordan Lawler, you can correct me if I'm thinking of a different player, but he's been very adamant that he's going to Vanderbilt. Like,
yeah,
he's been like saying that from day one.
So here's what it, like, you know, I don't want to just like repeat myself, so I'll give a little bit more context of just kind of like, if they go in the first, you know, 10 rounds, they'll sign. But unless a player, like, because you can actually remove yourself from the draft, unless you do that, I think that you're signable for the right number. Now, this was probably the floor. If Lawler had gone seventh or later, I think he would have gone to Vanderbilt, or would go to Vanderbilt. Where, I don't know about the past or present future tense on that one. It's hard when someone's committed to something.
He would go to Vanderbilt if he,
but yeah, I think if he had gone seventh or later, there's a strong chance he goes to Vanderbilt, because right now the Diamondbacks slot bonus is 5.74. And if he wants 6+, once you get past 7, it is very hard to make that bonus work. Now, he has an advantage in that, you know, there's always leverage for teams to basically say, or sorry, for the players to say, oh, well, if I don't sign, if you don't give me the figure, I'm going to go to college. Of course, teams can say, yeah, but if you don't sign, you got to go to college for 3 years and a lot of things can happen. Yeah. Maybe you end up, you know, keeping your value or even growing it. Maybe you don't, you know, there's kind of that mystery.
By a bus.
Yeah. There's the mystery box aspect of it. But with Lawler, he has a unique position because he's 19 and the draft was held later. He would be a draft eligible sophomore in 2 years. So he wouldn't have to go to college for the full 3 years. It just, you know, I know it's one less year and it might not seem like a big thing, but in terms of, you know, eliminating the possibilities of something going wrong, it's, you know, it's a fairly big deal, especially committed to a big program like Vanderbilt. I think the Diamondbacks will get him. I think they went under slot enough with the rest of their picks to probably be fine. In terms of some of these first round and, you know, specifically upper first round picks, this might be the hardest to pull off. This might be the deal that, you know, gets signed 1 second to the, you know, to the hour, you know, to get it done basically. But I would assume that it gets done until it doesn't.
All right. Well, I will tell Mama Hack to rest easy that they didn't waste a pick.
Yeah, I mean, like, to go off, I like their second pick, Ryan Bliss, you know, it's a college hitter and, you know, it was a pretty solid prospect himself, but, you know, probably going to be under slot. Adrian Del Castillo, you know, came into the year as like a legit top half of the first round talent and played terribly at the University of Miami. So that's kind of an interesting one, where he came in as, you know, a big prospect, played terrible, has probably played himself down a couple draft boards to maybe the third or fourth round kind of value. So that could be slot or less. And I think there's enough of these, some of these other picks that they made, you know, maybe some, you know, they had Jacob Steinmetz, who is a prep pitcher, you know, that could be potentially under slot. There's, you know, a bunch of other college players mixed in, probably going to be, most of them are going to be under slot. So I think they're going to get Lawler. I mean, Lawler, some people view him as the best player in the draft. So the Diamondbacks kind of just had to go. You got to decide at that point, you know, it's like, are you going to go for it or not? You know, there is most likely, I think, or most people probably projected Lawler to go second to the Rangers. So I assume the Diamondbacks were happy with this, made a call and were like, okay, what's the figure? And then said, okay, we need to figure out what we need to do from here. You know, there's enough time between your first pick and your second pick to kind of go, okay, we've got this guy, he's got this figure, we need to shuffle around our board and pick guys with a target dollar figure in mind.
All right. Well, then we will move on to next is the Royals.
Yeah, the Royals. The Royals are very strange sometimes in terms of, you know, they're, you know, they just kind of, you know, walk to the beat of their own drum, basically. So they go with Frank Mazzucato, who is a prep high school arm. Those players tend to, you know, scare teams early on, unless they're kind of the big, big time prospect. He was a late riser. You know, he's not a way off the board, you know, third or fourth round kind of talent, but he is probably going to be under slot. But, you know, with high rising guys, that's kind of what you're trying to get here, you know, for the Royals is like, okay, someone who is got some helium and maybe, you know, this time next year, we're saying, wow, you know, the Royals got to steal with the, you know, Mazzucato at seven, or they look really smart. But now they can kind of go, okay, well, he's got some helium, but he's not maybe had enough time to fully cement himself, so we can get a little deal cut here. And they use that money on, most likely most of that money on their second round pick and Ben Kudrna, K-U-D-R-N-A, Kudrna. I cannot pronounce it for the life of me. I haven't looked it up because I'm just going to try and like just power my way through it.
I was going to say, but like cheese curds, like, is that how we pronounce it? Curds?
I don't know. It could be, but he was a player that apparently had a big price tag. I think it was $3 million, but most scouts from what I've seen don't have him as a first round talent, which is, that's kind of a mismatch right there of, you know, when you have a player who's asking for a figure and go, okay, well, it's a bit of a stretch, but we like the talent. But if someone is being, you know, looked at more as like a second or third round talent, and they're asking for, you know, back of the first round kind of money, it gets a little dicey there. You know, I mean, that might not even be back of the first round. That's like, you know, I think solidly in the first round type of value. So they're likely going to move some of the savings from Mazzucato to him. But is this the kind of underslot deal that works? I think it's kind of mixed reviews right now. They did get Peyton Wilson in the compensation round B from Alabama. And he himself is a pretty solid college prospect. So, and Carter Jensen and Shane Panzini. So those were the next couple of picks. And I feel like those were all pretty solid takes anyway. So this could end up being a good draft, but I just kind of found it very difficult to kind of get around the idea of going prep pitcher as both the underslot and the overslot. It just kind of seemed like they, you know, maybe it wasn't a miscalculation. I think they knew who they wanted to take, and it might just be that they got certain looks on these guys and say, okay, well, Mazzucato is going to take a deal, and we think he's way, you know, worth way more than that, and we can also pick up, you know, a couple other interesting prep players along the way.
All right, well, then we are going to be moving on to the Rockies, the host of the All-Star game with Benny Montgomery in the first round. Another high school pick, which seems to be, you know, one of the things that teams do when they're kind of trying to gamble on a guy. So
yeah, how do you feel about that one? Yeah, Montgomery is a pretty toolsy guy, and the Rockies love to pick toolsy guys. You know, they picked Zach Levine last year in the first round, another prep outfielder. And, you know, this is also someone who probably is going to take a little bit of a deal, a little bit of an underslot. You know, he's still a first round talent. He's not quite like, you know, in comparison to Mazzucato. He's, I think, a little bit better of a prospect. So he'll take an underslot, but probably not too much. But I think it's enough to land their next guy, who's Jaden Hill, a college pitcher from LSU, who came into the year as potentially a top 10 pick, maybe even top five, depending on how his year shook out, but he got injured and season got derailed. So that combination of Montgomery and Hill, I think, is going to be potentially one of the better combos in terms of what we look at for underslot, overslot. I really did like it. You know, I kind of like the idea of being able to pick up some of these, you know, specifically college arms who maybe had a setback, and you're able to kind of grab onto that value. Like, you know, someone like Hill specifically, who could have gone, you know, very early, you're just not going to usually get that kind of talent in the second round. And then they go with Joe Rock, who's a solid prospect, McCabe Brown, Hunter Goodman. This is not, you know, going, okay, well, sometimes you see teams, they go overslot with a guy. you know, if it was for someone like Hill and go, okay, we need to just basically abandon, you know, picking any sort of legitimate prospect, they still got a few guys that, you know, are going to be potentially, you know, impacts in their farm system. So overall, I think the Rockies did a pretty solid job here.
All right. And then we're inching closer to the man that everybody is asking about, but where you have to go through the Angels first, who looks to be pitcher heavy here.
Yeah, that might be an understatement. They picked 20 pitchers with all 20 picks. Definitely an extreme, even in, you know, there's some of these other teams that went very pitcher heavy. The Angels really pushed it. You know, as an Angel fan, I can't say that I love this draft. You know, they picked Sam Bachman with their first pick. He is a, you know, power fastball, potential plus or better slider. Lots of concerns, though, when it comes to his injuries. He's had hip and shoulder issues, I believe, and those are, you know, I would say two very important parts of your body. So that is kind of tough. And you see that and you go, okay, well, this is a power arm who's got a little dinged up. Maybe they're saying, okay, we can kind of grab someone when his value, you know, someone with big potential, well, his value is not super high, go under slot and then go over slot later. But then they followed it with just a onslaught of pitchers, and specifically college pitchers. They picked 19 college pitchers in this draft. So there's not really someone here to go, okay, well, Bachman's the savings. We're going to go with, you know, we're going to kind of dump all this money to, say, someone like Bubba Chandler that we mentioned with the Pirates. Kai Bush was their next pick. He's pretty solid. He's kind of been going up some boards, you know, Landon Marcoux and then Luke Murphy, solid prospects, but still guys that you're going, okay, this is a bit of an overreach or underslot, however you want to put it. So it seems like the Angels could be, you know, trying to maybe save some money is the worst way that it, you know, the worst probably idea that it is, but it might be that they're just going very modeled focus, and college pitchers just tend to have better data available to them. So maybe they're doing that. I know there's some talks that they're going to shut down basically all of these pitchers and then not have to worry about placing them into their farm system this year, and then let their guys go this year and kind of let them loose next year and be able to kind of make some decisions before then. But I mean, they're the only prep pitcher they took was Mason Albright, who is a potential, you know, top 4 or 5 round type of prospect, and they got him in the 12th. So it's a little iffy there on signability. He came from the IMG Academy, but yeah, the deluge of college pitching is, maybe they're going, okay, yes, we know we need pitching, we get it. But I think it's just much more of a team looking to save a little bit of money while leaning heavily and just, you know, to an extreme on data-driven models.
All right. And then the pick everyone was interested in is Kumar Rocker, and he goes all the way to pick 10 and he goes to the Mets.
Yeah, the Mets just kind of did what I think a lot of teams fans would hope they do, and that's just not mess around. They went with who was likely the best player on the board that came into the year as either the number one or number two player on most scouts boards. So Rocker is potentially, you know, a number two, number three starter type. You know, right now he kind of looks like a number four. There's some great detail on him in our previous podcast with Keenan. And, you know, there's definitely some issues here. There's a reason why he's not going, you know, in the top two or three picks that he was projected to, but you know, you can't fault the Mets here. They, you know, they went with the best guy on the board, and that just sometimes that's just better. You know, there's definitely some years where teams look great for going under slot and scooping up some guys, but there's also times where just getting the best player is the best bet, you know, in terms of probabilities. And their, you know, their pool is 4.7. He's going to command more than that, most likely. I think there's a rumor that he already signed, but it's going to be more than that. And so when you look at their next few picks, it's not like a, you know, kind of like big time reach or anything like that, but you know, Calvin Ziegler, Dominic Hamill, JT Schwartz, Christian Scott, you know, these are solid picks, but probably, you know, a little bit of underslots in each area. Then they got a couple of college seniors, you know, like I mentioned earlier, kind of where you're really going to get most savings in the first 10 rounds. So yeah, I mean, the Mets get a guy in Rocker who could be up next year. I know there was, you know, some hope probably from some teams that, you know, him or Leiter could pitch this year. I just don't see it. You know, the last time we saw Rucker, it was the fastball velocity, fastball shape just did not look like someone who could consistently miss bats, you know, right now in the major leagues. He probably needs a little bit of work on that, but, you know, you're talking about, you know, one of the, you know, best, you know, in terms of looking like he's going to log a bunch of innings, you know, with what we're scared with pitchers going now, he's got, he looks like he's got a workhorse's, you know, workhorse frame. So yeah, good job on the Mets. Just, you know, not getting too cute and just going, all right, we're going to take the best guy.
For what it's worth, it does not look like Kumar is signed. So.
Okay. Yeah. I thought I saw, it might've been one of the fake, the you know, fake accounts posting as someone else. I thought I saw some sign. I was like, that would be insane for a guy like of his quality to get signed already.
Yeah. Based on a quick Twitter search, it doesn't look like it. So next up is going to be the Nationals, who a little peek behind the curtain. I've got notes that Rob has put on here for me. So I'm kind of getting lobbed some softball questions here, but not really the player that you thought they would like go for.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of hard to say. You know, if I had to kind of pick a guy at this point in the draft who they would have picked. Now, of course, one of the guys that we have not spoken about yet, who's one of the top prospects in the draft, that's Khalil Watson. We're going to get to him. You know, if you would just say, okay, best player on the board, you would expect them to take it. But if I had to kind of throw out a name, it'd be like, oh, it'd be like Gunnar Hoglund or something like that. A college pitcher who has some, you know, injury history or something like that. That's kind of where you've seen them, or really it's just like, you know, a big arm that they think that they can just develop. We saw it last year with Cade Cabal, we've seen it with Jackson Rutledge. They're not afraid to take arms early on the first round. And so with House, you have a prep player, shortstop right now, probably going to be a third baseman long term, big power. It's usually just not their MO, but at pick 11, this is, I thought it was great value. You know, there were some teams, I think, considering him in the top five, just as like someone to cut a deal with. They're probably going to have to go slot or slightly over here with him in comparison to some of those teams. But I think this is a great pick just in terms of value. You know, maybe there are some people you can quibble and say, well, if they're going to go value there, maybe they go Khalil Watson. It could be that just they internally have House over Watson. It could just be their preference. You know, from there, they kind of just took some underslot guys, you know, Lyle, Bozier, and Saenz. So it's like their next picks are not exactly flashy. Like I said, that's kind of what happens. You got to balance out the overslot and the underslot. So going overslot here, getting a big-time talent like House, you know, the rest of the draft wasn't too flashy. But, I mean, overall, I thought this was a great.
All right, and then we're going to be moving on to the Mariners next, which ended up going high school first.
Right, yeah. So the Mariners, they tend to lean college, and they're rumored to go college. I think they're rumored to go with someone like Sal Frelick or maybe even Colton Cowser if he had fallen past the Orioles. But instead they go Harry Ford, who's real, real toolsy college catcher. And yeah, I plugged our previous episode a bunch, but we talk about Ford, you know, in detail a little bit. But prep catchers are generally avoided in the first round, especially this early. It's just the demographic in terms of, you know, the history has just not played well. But Ford is toolsy enough where it's like you could see this guy potentially playing center field. You know, it's good speed, you know, potential for some good power. So I would say that this is, you know, pretty solid pick. You know, I might have preferred Watson, but, you know, it's a little bit different than their MO, which maybe surprised some people. But I think this is a pretty much solid of just picking, like, you know, a top player at the top of the board, not going too crazy. Their next pick, Edwin Arroyo, is one of the more interesting prospects in the draft. He's not exactly like a top prospect, but he's from Puerto Rico. He got announced as a shortstop, which means, of course, that he throws right-handed, but I believe he pitches left-handed, which I was just like, when I found that out, I was like, I do not get it. I do not understand how that's possible. You know, Shohei Ohtani's one thing, but I was like, I don't, you know, it was just like, oh, this is, this sounds really cool. I wish this would work as like a two-way player, but he's going to probably just go out as a shortstop. And so interesting prospect, Michael Morales and Bryce Miller, a couple other solid prospects, you know, nothing too crazy. Likely going forward, they're going to have to kind of use up a bunch of their slot there. So they kind of took it, you know, pretty standard after that. Lots of college players. That's the thing, though, is they made it up after taking three high schoolers with their first three picks. They ended up just going nuts on college players. So they kind of made up for it there.
All right. And then we move to everyone's favorite Otter, and we go to the Phillies, which kind of had an interesting draft in and of themselves.
Yeah, the Phillies, they kind of seem like they might have a guy in terms of just interesting prep arm. Last year, they picked McAble, which is looking like a great pick. This year, they go with Andrew Painter, who at one point looked like he was going to be the top prep pitcher over Jackson Jobe. And, you know, even then, Jobe was just not really like on the radar as a prep pitcher. So Painter looked like he was going to be the number one. He did not perform to that level. So he kind of fell a bit, but, you know, 13, you know, he fell down boards, but still goes to 13. So Philly seemed to, you know, enjoy their prep arms that might play up to kind of a bigger level. And then they go Ethan Wilson in the second round, who is a pretty good college outfield prospect. And so he is, you know, a little bit more toolsy than you would expect from a guy going in the second round for a college outfielder. So a couple of interesting picks there. You know, after that, it was maybe not the biggest of drafts, you know, kind of when you go, like I said, when you kind of go really strong in those first two, it's a little bit difficult. But, you know, Painter is a 6'7" frame pitcher, and it's like, okay, well, that's, you know, that's going to be tough to pull off, but it could be, you know, it could be, you know, maybe not front end of the rotation. That's always hard to project, but it could be pretty high. Wilson's a solid get in the second round. So overall, I think it's a, you know, pretty solid draft from Philly.
So, and then from there, we go from Philly to reigning College World Series champion, Will Bednar. And he goes to the Giants. And so it's kind of like in your notes, it seems like they would have gone somewhere else, but I guess the Omaha High got to him.
Yeah, this seemed like Khalil Watson, who I mentioned before, who is going to come up very soon. This looked like where Watson was going to go, and it sounds like that deal fell through. And so San Francisco changed up their plan, and they actually ended up going very pitcher heavy at the beginning as well, especially on the college side. But they go with Will Bednar, who is, you know, probably a little bit of a late riser, even as a college player. And it's probably a little bit of underslot. And I kind of feel like this was almost similar to Baltimore, where, you know, you see like Will Bednar go, and it's like, okay, Bednar is probably considered more of a late first, early second type of prospect. He's getting picked here at 14. Maybe they're going to save some money and go after, you know, one of the kind of remaining prep players. And instead they go with Matt Mikulski, who pitcher from Fordham, and it's definitely not an overslot guy there too. And then Mason Black is a pitcher from Lehigh in Pennsylvania, high school arm. And then they go with another pitcher. Oh, sorry. Lehigh is a college. I'm sorry for all the Lehigh college collegiate fans out there, but they go college arm, college arm, college arm, and then prep arm, and then college arm, college arm, college arm. There's not a ton here in terms of like, okay, the money you save from Bednar and Mikulski, this is what you're using it on. You know, Eric Silva, their fourth round pick from Jay Serra, potentially that's going to be where they're going to put a little bit of money. But even then, he was more of a fourth round prospect anyway. So it could be that maybe he just had a big price tag. They like him. They want to get some money shifted down there.
All righty, then we're going to hit the halfway point of the draft of the league. We're going to go to the Brewers next.
Yeah, so for the Brewers, they really like college hitters. That's kind of their another model-driven team. They picked a bunch of college hitters throughout the draft. they started with Sal Frelick, who could have potentially gone to the top 10 in terms of just a really solid college bat coming out of Boston College. They go then with Tyler Black, and it's, again, one of those cases where, you know, you're looking at it and go, okay, maybe they're going to save a little bit of money here. And I think that's going to really come from not really Russell Smith, their third round pick, who's coming out of TCU, but from Alex Benlas, who's coming out of Louisville, the college, not, you know, not a high school guy, but he was considered a, you know, fairly top prospect as well. Still fell to the third round. I think he was maybe more of a second round prospect. So it could be someone that they're going to have to just give a little bit more there. So it might be just, it kind of balances out. It's not a huge overslot, underslot kind of movement there, but they get a couple of college bats. You know, they tend to go college heavy just overall. You know, pretty solid draft. I mean, they picked a couple, couple of top 100, you know, to 150 range prospects in Rock Riggio and Carter Holton later on in the draft in the 11th and 19th round. I'm not sure if that's really where they're going to be able to move money. You can't, you know, that's not quite, you know, the cutoff is really for the first 10 rounds and the second 10 rounds for how the pool works. But if they get one of those guys, maybe we'll look at this draft even more positively. But I mean, overall, I think getting a couple of college, you know, batters like this is, you know, pretty much their style, and it, you know, it looks like it's going to work.
And now you get to talk about, you know, someone you've talked about a couple of picks earlier with Khalil Watson. That is our next pick going to the Marlins.
Yeah. So Khalil Watson, I think, was there. I wouldn't be surprised if you could find some scouts who thought he was the best player of the draft. And he was probably solidly in the top five or so for a lot of people, you know, pretty much, I would then say a consensus top 10, but, you know, definitely more in that top five range. And he falls down here to 16, and he's definitely going to be a tough sign. But if a team is picking him, I think there is discussions here. What makes it more interesting is then their next pick, Joe Mack, in the competitive balance round, is also considered a top 25-ish draft prospect, and they got him at 31. So generally, when you go overslot, that's where things might get a little dicey in terms of how bonuses are going to work. And then even Cody Morissette, their second round pick, he's a, you know, top two round prospect as well. So there's not a ton of, you know, reaches going on here. So it's going to be a little bit trickier for them to probably make it work. But I think they picked enough in terms of, you know, college seniors and, you know, basically those types of players to potentially make it work. But the Marlins might have had one of the best drafts, you know, just in terms of the number of, you know, actual legit prospects they were able to pick up. So I think this was pretty solid, you know, and just in terms of, and they didn't really have to do, you know, it's not like they had to do any sort of crazy deal. It just, they basically let Watson come to them, and they didn't get scared of, you know, picking someone like Watson and then going immediately to college. And, you know, in their first couple of picks after that, they go still just going for that upside. So I think it was a pretty impressive draft for the Marlins.
Do you see any of those three top picks maybe not signing? I don't know much about Joe Mack or Cody Morissette, but do you see any of them saying, hey, like, I'll go back for another year, or maybe they're out of eligibility for all I know? Is there anything in that?
Yeah. So Mack is a high school player as well, along with Watson. So if they go into school, it's going to be for, you know, 3 years. So I kind of don't see them, unless, I think that's just going to be like a bonus thing. Like, if basically Watson is just like, all right, I'm going to need $7 million not to go to campus, and the Marlins just simply like can't make it work in terms of the numbers, you might get in trouble there. But I would assume that, you know, his number is probably more, you know, maybe like five-ish, and they just kind of got to move some money around to make it work. You know, Mack, I would assume that if you know, that they did their due diligence and are, I think it's going to work, because that, like I said, that's kind of tricky to pick, you know, in the first, you know, they had to pick at 16 and 31, and they get, you know, a top five and a top 25 or even 20 player in Mack. It's, that generally doesn't work bonus wise, but, you know, they could have, you know, spoken to the guys and feel comfortable. You know, Morissette is a college shortstop, so he could technically go back. it's always tricky with college players to go back for that 1 year if you're getting basically drafted at pretty much your, you know, where it looks like you're supposed to go. You know, like he is like a top two or three round player. And if he's going in round, you know, basically the middle of round two, it's probably tough to beat that, you know, unless the Marlins are really underestimating the kind of bonus that he's looking for. I would assume that all these guys make it, you know, just as kind of like my blanket, like just assume that, you know, 99% of the first 10 rounds are going to get signed. But the Marlins are definitely up there with the Diamondbacks in terms of just like, okay, they really got to probably have the, you know, have this go down the wire to make it work.
Gotcha. So then we go to older brother of Sun Devil legend, Sean McClain, and Matt McClain, and going to the Reds, who had the most picks in the first couple rounds here. So they kind of had a way to take a lot of the guys they probably wanted in early rounds.
Yeah. So with the, when you have a little bit of a extra picks and, you know, so they had like a compensation pick for Bauer, and then they had a competitive balance pick. And so having those pretty early on, you know, gives you a lot of bonus flexibility, but for them, they probably would have really hoped that Watson made it just a little bit longer. You know, that's the kind of player where it's just like, okay, well, now you have a lot of pool money, you can give it to him and kind of make it work. Without one of those, you know, true kind of top elite guys getting there, you can kind of see the strategy kind of playing out a little bit differently in terms of, you know, maybe you would expect, you know, they kind of went more college focused than I would expect from something like this. You know, I compare it to a couple of years ago when the Diamondbacks had a ton of draft picks, even more than the Reds, and they picked up a lot of high school guys, you know, were able to move the bonus money around and got a great class out of it. You know, they started with Matt McClain, like you said, and he's called shortstop, you know, might be a shortstop, might not, you know, that's kind of one of the digs on him, but he came into the year as a top 5 to 10 prospect. He maybe played himself more into like the 10 to 20 range, but at 17, I think that's a pretty solid value. Jay Allen is, you know, a kind of more maybe fringy first round guy, but it's, you know, pretty solid value. And then Matthew Nelson is maybe went a little bit higher than you would expect, but not that much higher, but that's another college player. They go college with Andrew Abbott and as well with Jose Torres. And so in their first few picks, that's a lot of college guys for all that bonus money. You kind of expect it usually to kind of go more of those big upside kind of guys, but I liked it. They definitely picked up a lot of, you know, a lot of really solid guys. You know, maybe their farm isn't going to end up being, you know, at the top of, you know, a lot of people's rankings, but it's going to be deeper. It's going to be much deeper than some of these other teams who are kind of coming out of it with maybe one or two, you know, fairly legit prospects. They might come out of it with 5, 6, even 7, you know, because there's still guys like Justice Thomas, Kevin Abel, Thomas Farr. Like there's, you know, they got, you know, off the top of my head, probably like 7 or 8, like top, you know, 150-ish prospects for this draft. So that's a pretty good haul. And that's what you need. You know, it's if for something like this, like if Kumar Rocker or Jack Leiter had fallen to them, they could have made it work. They would have had to, you know, give up a fair amount of this stuff and then kind of just go, all right, college senior for a bunch of picks. But, you know, without a top guy falling to them, they, I think, made it work and definitely had one of the more solid drafts of all the teams.
I don't disagree there. I think they probably had the most advantageous like scenario in terms of where their picks, you know, were in terms of like when they were picking, because they got a lot fast and then they could kind of take a, you know, take some time and think about how they're going to do the second half of the draft and see how things were going. Okay. So next we've got the Cardinals. And they do what the Cardinals do. They take a college pitcher just like they always do.
Yeah, it was funny. I mean, the thing is with this, it's like I don't think Michael McGreevy, who is their pick, is like that much of a reach by any mean or anything like that. You know, obviously there's the Cardinals devil magic that everyone just assumes they're going to pick some random guy, you know, cheap bonus or whatever term is. But I mean, McGreevy is legit. He is a sinker baller, which, you know, maybe with the crackdown on all the sticky stuff, maybe he plays up a little bit better, but it's still a solid pick. He definitely has some helium, which, you know, sometimes when we see a guy's rankings, we always, you know, if you're looking at like kind of different places, whether it's, you know, MLB.com, Fangraphs, Baseball Prospectus, ESPN, all that kind of stuff, you know, you never know when the looks and stuff like that for certain players came in. And so when someone has helium, you know, maybe they're higher up on everyone's boards. And we just kind of don't see that reflected in public rankings. But, you know, it looks like a solid pick, probably going to be a little bit under slot. And that's because they're going to give most of that savings to their next pick in Joshua Baez, who is a big, big dude, big power hitter. And I think if you're a Cardinals fan, you're looking at him and hoping he is this year's Jordan Walker, who of course is probably going to be their top prospect, you know, for most people, you know, maybe behind Nolan Gorman. Walker, another huge dude with power, who's now playing extremely well in the minors. And so I think the hope is Baez is going to be the next version of that. So he's the overslot guy here. And so this is actually kind of a great kind of example is, you know, using MLB.com's kind of just rankings, just like as an offhand, you know, just because they got the nifty little draft tracker, you know, the Cardinals were picking 18th and 54th. Well, they picked the 28th best player at 18, but got the 24th best player at 54. And you'd think, okay, well, why didn't they just pick Baez at 18th if they like him so much? And it's like, well, there's leverage. You know, you're hoping that a guy fallen, you know, maybe his number isn't so hard, you know, such a hard cap that needs to be a certain level. If you pick Baez 18th, maybe instead of, you know, X amount, he wants 15% higher, something like that. So in terms of an overslot, underslot strategy, I thought this was a great combo by the Cardinals. And I mean, their next couple of picks between Holgate and Love were pretty solid. They got Alex Willis later on, who was probably more like a round 4 or 5 prospect. They got him in the 7th round. So, I mean, overall, the Cardinals, I think, did pretty well here.
So from there, we go to our other colored bird team with the Blue Jays, who we had the Reds, who had a lot of picks early, to the Blue Jays, who had a pick and then had to wait like 2 days to figure out who they're going to take next.
Yeah, so teams lose, you know, so with basically free agency, you know, the Blue Jays lost their second round pick in order to sign George Springer. And so when you have a team in this position, and the Dodgers are like this, so we'll get to them later on, but you really need to make your first and your third pick in tandem probably really work. And so what I mean by that is you basically either got to find a diamond in the rough who maybe you save some stuff in the save some slot on, for the first round, and then hit on a third rounder, big upside, something like that. Or you kind of go with what the Blue Jays did. And I just, you know, up front, I actually love this pick. And they went with Gunnar Hoglund, who had Tommy John, which, of course, you know, saying that you love a pick and the guy's already had Tommy John maybe doesn't sound that great, but he could have potentially been a top 10 player in the draft, you know, as if he had stayed healthy and pitched well. And that's a lot of ifs, sure. But in terms of talent, you know, getting someone like that here at 19 is generally not, you know, not possible, especially from a college player when teams are definitely have a preference for college players. So getting someone like that at 19, you know, is Tommy John, you're able to kind of control the rehab. You know, there's some concerns about his body in terms of just, you know, the shape of it, I guess you would say. And so maybe you get him in a good workout program and it could be a big hit. And that's kind of what you need to do here because they don't have that second pick. And it's really not even about the pick. It's more about the slot money that is attached to it because you don't get that money to be able to use on other players. So you kind of have to be both creative and careful and to different degrees. So here they kind of go, okay, well, get a college pitcher. Sure, he's injured, but this could be a top 10 prospect from this draft, and we get him down at 19 and maybe at, you know, a little bit of a savings. But I think he's probably going to go for slot pretty much. And it's just kind of a, you know, decent strategy. We'll see if it pays off. Overall, you know, I liked it just because I, you know, I like Hoglund enough to think that it's a good get, but you know, the rest of their draft wasn't, you know, blow you away. And that kind of, like I said, happens. when you don't have a second pick, you know, they have Tiedemann, Chad Dallas, Irv Carter. You know, Irv Carter could be, you know, he's a high school pitcher. He probably will actually get a little bit of an overslot maybe from the savings from Hoagland if Hoagland goes underslot at all. Tiedemann is actually a JUCO player, junior college. So that's probably going to be an underslot pick. But I mean, overall for kind of what you get in terms of this draft, you know, plus George Springer, of course, you know, you can't really disconnect the two. I think it was pretty solid.
Well, yeah. If you're trading for George Springer, giving up a couple picks isn't the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
So, all right. So we're gonna move on to the Yankees, and their first pick was Trey Sweeney. How do you feel about them?
Yeah. So the Yankees, they are not exactly the craziest draft to follow. They play it fairly safe. They are also a analytics heavy team, and you know, every team at this point does, you know, use analytics, but some of them are, you know, to maybe just a greater extent, and the Yankees are one of them. So they end up picking, you know, a lot of college players, and they end up with Trey Sweeney, who, you know, lefty hitter, could, you know, legit be, you know, strong bat. Listed as a shortstop, maybe he's not a shortstop long term. You know, the bat isn't blow you away. Kind of that's part of the reason why, you know, he was more of like a round two prospect, and they go with him here at 20 just because he probably plays out better in their formulas, and that's just the way they want to go. You know, Brendan Beck from Stanford is, you know, it's not like in the second round they go and get a underslot guy. It's like, you know, Beck is pretty much like a pitchability, you know, not massive stuff, but is probably going to pitch in the big leagues. And so that's kind of just the theme of their picks, is just a lot of, okay, well, this guy is not exactly, you know, lighting up, you know, everyone, you know, when they're in the draft and they're just talking about this guy. It's like, oh, tools and all this potential. It's like, it's more a bunch of solid players, and, you know, we'll kind of just see, you know, see how it works out. It's always interesting, you know, hearing about these teams are very much drafting off of, you know, their analytical models. You know, if Sweeney goes out and just doesn't hit, you know, that's a lot of teams are going to look at that and kind of look at it as a missed opportunity based on some of the guys on the board. But, you know, it could be that the Yankees are able to, you know, maybe they're seeing something here. They also got, you know, a couple of other good guys, you know, Selvidge, Bowman, Hardman, Fitz. It's not a bad draft. It just, I don't think it's going to be one that right away it blows his way, but you know, maybe Sweeney goes out and he gets into high end double A and he's still raking, and we go, okay, Yankees are onto something here.
And then we go to what, based on your notes and what I'm reading, is probably one of the biggest gambles in the draft in terms of the Cubs trying to take Jordan Wicks, and then kind of the next two rounds saying like, well, we'll see what happens here. Like we'll kind of not like spend a ton of money, but we're going to try to get Wicks.
Yeah. Wicks is big in terms of just someone who could legitimately just pitch in the big leagues very quickly. So it's lefty, good changeup. You know, it's not quite the lefty good changeup, or it's just like, there's a lot of those guys that get into the minors and it's like they're carving up the minors, and as soon as they get the majors, they just don't have the fastball to get there. He still has a good enough fastball. It just, maybe the breaking ball isn't good enough for him to be more than a number four, but you know, this is, you know, he's probably more, you know, if you had to pick in terms of players most likely to start the most amount of games in the majors among the pitchers, I mean, he's up there. You know, it's he could pitch in the majors, you know, like I said, very quickly, but it's just not in terms of a, you know, a profile. It might just not blow you away. You know, then they go after Triantos and Gray and Franklin, and it goes, okay, well, maybe they're saving a little bit of money with the Wicks pick, but they, you know, they might, you know, they might get something out of this. You know, Triantos is a pretty good prospect. Franklin himself is, you know, one of those kind of odd, you know, performers, but doesn't blow you away type of tools. You know, that's sometimes those guys are, you know, maybe if everything is a 50 tool on the 20 to 80 scale, maybe it ends up one of those clicks in a 55 or 60, and it's like a really good you know, player, you know, it could be, it's a, you know, it's a very interesting collective of first four picks. I think it's definitely not bad by any means. Maybe it's not just blow you away, but I think the Cubs did overall pretty fine here.
And then moving from north side to south side, we go to the White Sox. What are your thoughts on them?
Yeah, the White Sox, in comparison of, you know, their pick, you know, Wicks is like this, you know, pitchability, ready for the majors type of pitcher. So the White Sox, who go with Colson Montgomery, who is big tools, probably 4 or 5 years away from the bigs. And it just, you know, with Colson Montgomery, you just, it could be all or nothing. It's, you know, it could be a lot of fun. It could be a guy that just doesn't get really, you know, out of low A or high A. It's just, that's kind of how it goes. Like after some of these kind of high end first round, you know, high end first round high school players, you never really know. But White Sox love tools, and you know, they go with Wes Kath, who is, you know, big time power. You know, I think he was originally shortstop in high school. They picked him as a third baseman. You know, like I said, could be some big power. Sean Burke is, you know, pretty solid college pitching prospect himself. He has, you know, really good spin rates that, you know, a lot of teams love. You know, it's a pretty solid 1-2-3. You know, the rest of their draft, I think they kind of went, you know, especially in the first 10 rounds, they picked a lot of, you know, a lot of college players, I think, because, you know, these, especially the first two picks with the high schoolers, are going to cost a little bit more in terms of overslot, but, you know, pretty, I would say overall pretty solid.
And then I don't have a segue other than that the Indians took all college players.
Yeah, the Cleveland's strategy, actually, well, no, they picked one high schooler, I think. Oh, no, it might have been two.
You're lying to me in your notes then.
Oh, well, I apologize for that.
All 10 picks for college, but that's not my that's not your fault. That's my fault because I was not prepared. So
no, it's all right. So yeah, they actually went with Jake Fox in the third round, who was a high school shortstop. They picked all pitchers, is what I think I meant to say, except for one. And so yeah, they picked. But yeah, they pretty much went college pitcher, you know, to an extreme, like the Angels. You know, their first pick is Gavin Williams, who kind of seemed like a little bit of a riser as well. You know, it might just be that Cleveland's just a pitching machine, and they're going to turn these guys into Cy Young candidates. You know, Doug Nikazi, Tommy Mace, Ryan Webb, you know, Tanner Bibby. It's what I would say about their draft, you know, not without going through every single name, because they picked actually a fair amount. Like in terms of, you look at their draft board and just like, you know, top 150 to top, you know, 200 ish prospects, they pick some of the most, but it's just not blow you away. And so that's kind of another strategy, is that if you, you know, don't pick, you know, any real high end guys, you can kind of like level it out and pick a lot of, you know, solid prospects. It's a lot of pitchers who have some pitchability or throw strikes or some, you know, maybe good spin rates. It's stuff that Cleveland looks for. And so their draft is going to be one of those things, like right now, if you just kind of took it as a, you know, all you did was look at their scouting reports, their scouting rankings, all that kind of stuff, and then where they picked, you'd go, Cleveland had a okay draft. It could be in a year where it's just like, oh, they got them into the pitching factory, and now they have, you know, the next Shane Bieber, basically. That's kind of the thing with Cleveland. It's like, it's very difficult to just almost view their draft in a vacuum, because we know how much they're able to basically change these guys once they get into Pro Bowl.
All righty. And then we go to the South, and we're going to go to the Braves. And I'll let you take it away, because I don't know any of these people.
Yeah. So Ryan Cusick is a big, big, big time fastball. It's, you know, fastball slider combo that if he could, you know, maybe it's pitching this year in the majors. If the Braves were, you know, more in contention, it's that kind of stuff. But when I say, you know, pitching on the bullpen now, it's, he might be in the bullpen long-term. So once you're kind of moving into this back half of the first round, it's, you know, all these players overall are going to have the, you know, this guy might make it, he might not type of, you know, kind of just bust you know, concern. But then you're also kind of looking at some of these guys who go, okay, well, maybe some of these high-end players, there's like potential for them to be an all-star, there's potential for them to be a regular and stuff like that. You're kind of coming down now more into the, well, this guy could be pretty solid, pretty good pitcher, but, you know, Cusick could very easily just be in the pen very quickly. Spencer Schwellenbach is a, you know, pretty solid pick in the second round. I would say it's both of these picks were pretty much just like, were chalk. He was a two-way player. He didn't get announced as one. Actually, no one got announced as a two-way player, which they actually, that designation was available. So yeah, announced as a shortstop. And so, you know, I would say that's a, you know, fairly solid pick. Dylan Dodd and Cal Conley, their next couple of picks were maybe a bit above the, you know, in terms of, you know, where they might go. So some potential underslot there. It just, they kind of, you know, Atlanta just has their kind of style and they basically just stick with it. You know, they just kind of have certain guys that they just like and they kind of follow it to a T, and that was pretty much what they did this year. So, I mean, I think it overall could be a still shape up to be a solid draft though.
Okay. And then probably the most coincidental name, Max Muncy goes first round to the A's. But I have a biased reason to ask you about a pick in round 6 through 10 for the A's. And I'll let you go through the rest of it, and then we'll get to my main man.
All right, yeah. So Max Muncy, I know there are some people who are hoping he'd end up with the Dodgers. You know, Muncy's a pretty solid high school hitting prospect. It's, you know, middle infielder, looks like he can rake. That was, you know, kind of a big theme that we've had going through these picks and throughout the draft was, you know, a lot of teams kind of are really liking the guys who can for sure stick up the middle and swing the bat. You know, he is probably going to be overslot. So A's kind of went under the rest of the way, and Zach Geloff, Mason Miller, you know, Denzel Clark could be basically slot though. So that's, you know, that might be it, but, you know, Geloff is, you know, got a nice little, you know, well-rounded, but yeah, Clark is in comparison is like a, you know, outfielder from Cal State Northridge, which with like monster tools. And so that's like a small school college, you know, college outfielder. And so that's kind of, you know, maybe someone that you're basically in the fourth round, you're hoping that pops and plays more like a first round talent to kind of pair with Muncy. But I mean, overall, this was a, I'd say a fairly solid draft for the A's. You know, they kind of didn't fit into a, you know, particular box. They went hitter heavy early on, which is not too much of a surprise, but in comparison to most teams, it was hitter heavy. They basically kind of flipped the switch and then halfway through kind of started digging more into pitchers.
And then I've got to talk about them. There's no bone in my body that can hold me back from talking about Drew Swift. the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Sun Devil, Drew Swift. Happy to see him go there. And he's, whether it's in Oakland, or if you're an Oakland fan and you don't want to hear it, cover your ears and you're going and they go to Vegas, he will be the perfect athletic no matter what. I promise you. He's one of those guys that he's a Willie Bloomquist. He's a David Eckstein. He's a whatever you want to name him. He's all of it and more. So he's a gamer, and I'm happy to see him actually, you know, get somewhere where I think is going to, you know, fit him really well. And I think he'll be an Eric Sogard kind of guy for a lot of teams. I think he's one of those journeyman guys.
Yeah. It's kind of tricky now with how much they, you know, team shift, how much that's really going to matter, because he's just not a big dude. I think they have him listed at 6'1", 165. Yeah. And, you know, so he's got to get stronger because, you know, you got to be able to still, you know, drive the ball. Some of those guys like Eckstein and stuff, they're, you know, they're basically unicorns. So, I mean, it's for the eighth round. That's a pretty solid pick, though. That's, you know, that's someone to be able to find someone who is for sure a shortstop and, you know, has some feel for hit, you know, that's someone who, you know, could end up being someone who just fits into a team down the line that you just never really thought of until like all of a sudden, whoa, like this guy's here. You know, I doubt it's going to be like a fill out and all of a sudden hit, you know, 15-20 home runs. Yeah,
never.
or anything like that. But, you know, for an eighth rounder, you know, it's, it's definitely, you know, definitely seems like a better, you know, better than your average eighth rounder. That's for sure. It's better than most guys, you know, going, you know, after the first couple of rounds. And it's funny because then they pair it with like Grant Holman, who's a pitcher at Cal. And it's like a kind of like almost opposites, where it's like a 6'6", like 250 frame. And it just like, they got some, a couple of guys I like after the fifth round and those two. So, you know, the A's I think did pretty well here.
Yeah, and I would never expect Drew Swift to hit more than 15 home runs in a major league season. Like, it's not who he is, but he is that guy who is going to play, you know. I mean, he was defensive player of the year in the Pac-12. And on top of that, he's one of those guys that he just knows how to ambush people. And he's like, he goes up and, you know, in probably one of the biggest at bats of his ASU career, and he just swings first pitch and just knocks one somewhere, and you know, everybody's running. Like, he just has a feel for how he can like make the bat work. But enough of me being a homer, so we'll move on to the Twins at pick 26.
Yeah, so that the Twins are kind of one of those teams that like almost don't have anything too strong to say. This is just a pretty solid draft up and down. Like, Chase Petty is a big time high school arm. He's, you know, with a lot of big time high school arms, you know, there's going to be the refining the command, you know, feel and things like that. It's going to be a big bonus. So, you know, they didn't go too crazy the rest of it, but you know, Noah Miller in the second round is, you know, solid pick, you know, or sorry, he was actually in a competitive bounce round A. And then, so that's a solid pick. He was probably more like an actual second rounder. You know, Steven Hajar, the same thing. It's like second round, maybe it was a third round pick. So you kind of got to save a little bit there. Christian McLeod from Mississippi State is, you know, kind of an interesting fifth rounder. Cause I think there's, you know, maybe a little bit more there. You know, he was a, you know, fairly decent prospect going around five. So that could end up being a nice little find there. And then Noah Cardenas in the eighth round, catcher from UCLA. If I had to pick, you know, some of these, you know, outside of the kind of like your, you know, big top guys that fall, he's probably like one of the later in the half of the, you know, like the round six to 10 to, you know, he's probably has the best chance to have a major league career. It seemed like he kind of picked it up. He went out and, you know, maybe kind of played himself back into being drafted. You know, there's a chance that he might've gone back to school. So that's kind of an interesting pick, but I mean, the Twins overall, I think that was pretty solid. They didn't, you know, besides, you know, going a little overslot with Petty, you know, there's nothing too out of the blue. You know, Petty might be their best prospect at this point, you know, based on, you know, Lewis's injury and graduation. So yeah, I think the Twins did pretty good here.
All right, so we're down to our final four. We're down to the Padres, Rays, Dodgers, and Astros. In these last four groups, is there anything that surprised you? Is there anything, you know, really specific that you want to call out?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think we could really just with who's up next in the Padres is Jackson Merrill was an interesting pick in the first round. I think most of the stuff I had seen just kind of like around the league did not have him anywhere close to this. It's, you know, it's a high school bat. And most scouts had him as like a second or third round player. And so picking this late, you'd go, okay, well, that is clearly going to be a underslot pick. And they definitely went overslot with the next one. And they got James Wood, who is maybe not the kind of like Bubba Chandler top player, but it seems like a guy that they like. He goes to the IMG Academy, which for those of you who don't know, the IMG Academy among other schools is basically fake. You go there to play sports. It's pretty much just in terms of like just getting guys to, whether it's college football or getting drafted for baseball, they're pretty much just like sports factories. So it generally takes quite a bit of money to get those guys to come out to get drafted. And so, you know, you'll see them. They're like one of the most common schools that you'll see sprinkled throughout the draft. But Wood is, you know, like 6'6", 6'7", 240 pounds, outfielder, massive power, maybe the best power in the draft. It's it is, you know, it's quite the profile. Maybe it's like Franmil Reyes, I guess, if I had to just kind of throw out a random player in terms of just size and power, lefty bat. So that seemed like the main get right there with taking Merrill in the first round, but then they get Robert Gasser in the competitive rounds bound B. And, you know, he himself is also a, you know, pretty solid prospect. So they didn't really go with much of a savings there. So the first three rounds is, it's kind of interesting, but from there they kind of went, you know, college pitchers, kind of a little bit, you know, down the line, didn't do too crazy. But then in rounds 18 and 20, they got Gage Jump and Chase Burns respectively. And those are guys who were expected to be, you know, second round type of players. You know, likely they're asking for first round bonuses. You know, going in the 18th and 20th round, I would put the chances of them signing probably below 5%, maybe even as low as 1% or lower. You know, it's never not zero, but it'd be very difficult. You know, that's kind of more of a extended conversation and maybe something happens. But in terms of their draft, you know, wasn't blown away with the Merrill pick. Felt like, you know, maybe there was some better options there on the board to save money. Unless they just really, you know, love Wood and love Gasser and just wanted to be able to get those guys.
All righty. And so now everybody's favorite analytics team, the Rays.
Yeah, the Rays, you know, for how everyone is going, you know, models, models, models. I've said it, you know, multiple times this draft. They generally are too, but this year they went high school hitters. And generally those guys don't have great data on them just because, you know, the batted ball, there's no batted ball data. Of course, you can basically throw away any high school stats, you know, in terms of high school games. You know, maybe there's some stuff at, you know, the, whether it's any kind of combine or scouting game or anything, you know, those, you know, area codes and stuff like that. You have different tournaments, but there's generally not a lot of stuff there. So they go with Carson Williams, Cooper Kinney, and as their first two picks, a couple of high school up the middle can probably hit, you know, kind of fit into that pattern of what we're seeing a lot from the high school. Then they go with Kyle Manzardo in the third round. That's a, you know, Washington State bat. Then they go right back to Kyle Manzardo was a second rounder. I keep on forgetting about these competitive balance rounds. Manzardo in the second round, they go with Ryan Spikes, who's also, you know, high school up the middle. They go with Drew Baker, Texas Tech third baseman. So a lot of bats early on, you know, even Mason Auer in the fifth round. So a lot of bats, you know, much, much more high school than a lot of these teams in comparison. And then, of course, after they pick those, you know, six players, they just go pitcher with almost every single pick after that. So they kind of joined the trend, you know, going from there. But in terms of their, you know, their strategy, it's definitely a little bit of a zag compared to some teams, but it's nothing quite, you know, way off the board where you're just like, you know, scratching your head. It's just kind of like, all right, well, these are some guys that, you know, have some feel for hit, can probably stay, you know, on the dirt and be able to perform.
All right. And we're down to our final two. First, we're going to go out to LA. With one of the better first names of the draft in Maddux.
Yeah, Maddux Bruns is the first pick for the Dodgers. They didn't have a second rounder. And similar to what Toronto had to pull, you kind of need to do something here. You know, if you kind of just go chalk, you might be a little bit in trouble in terms of your slot. And so they go with someone who is a little off the board, probably more of a second round type of prospect, someone who's got big stuff, but big time command issues. And basically the Dodgers are just going to bet on their player development, which of course, you know, is one of the best in baseball. So that's the kind of guy you want, is just, all right, this guy's going to provide potential first round value in terms, or, you know, upper first round value basically, but we're going to get him at 29 and you're not going to have to stress the, you know, the bonus kind of having to move slot stuff around because you don't have that second rounder. From there, you know, they go with Peter Hubick, who in the third round pretty much was basically where he was expected to go. So nothing, you know, way too off the board, just kind of, you know, it's just, you know, when you don't have the second pick, it kind of changes up a little bit. But you know, it's, they didn't pick a lot of strike throwers. That's a little bit of kind of what I would say though, with some of these other picks, you know, they went very pitcher heavy. They ended up actually finally picking a hitter in the 16th round as well as the 18th round. They're one of the few teams that didn't really like push some of the pitchability. They went stuff. They went with, you know, a lot of guys who are going to need some work, but maybe have a little bit more upside. So a very Dodgers draft is kind of how I'd put it, where you're just kind of putting a lot of trust into that player development and just saying, okay, well, we lost this pick. We need to be able to still get some value out of it. And I mean, after, you know, last year, they've already had a couple of their first, you know, late first round, second round type players already turning into legitimate prospects. So, you know, they got something, they got something going on. And so this is kind of just more fitting into that pattern.
There, and if you're going to bet on player development, the Dodgers aren't a bad team to bet on. So,
absolutely.
Then we're going to round it out, and at pick 30, or I guess not even pick 30, it's pick 60 something or 90 something, with the last round is the Astros, who really had to kind of sit on their hands for a while.
Yeah, so they lost the first two picks with the whole, you know, scandal and whatnot. So
the whole Astros thing.
Yeah, the whole Astros thing. So they picked, their first pick was at number 87. And so it's very difficult because, as mentioned before, you not only lose the pick, but you lose the money associated with. So we had them going, we have them last, you know, even though they technically picked, you know, somewhere more in like the middle of the first round. Just because, you know, they didn't have a first round pick, but, you know, in their first pick in round three, they went with Tyler Whitaker from Bishop Gorman, which if you do any research is a fairly popular baseball school in Nevada. And if you're going to go, you know, with someone in your first pick, when you don't have, you know, a pick in round one or two, this is pretty solid. You know, they're going for upside here. They're really trying to, you know, hit on someone who could bring back that first or second round quality in terms of a prospect, you know, while, you know, they're going to have to dish out, you know, higher bonus. The slot at the slot is, you know, under 700,000. It's probably going to take, you know, a million, you know, 1.5 or even higher to get Whitaker. So, you know, they're just basically going, okay, well, we're not going to get, you know, a lot of quantity here. So let's get quality. And their fourth pick, and they actually had a fourth round of compensation pick. Those next two were Alex Loa and Chase McDermott. And those two were also, you know, fairly solid. You know, they didn't go, okay, we're going to pick Whitaker and then basically just go right immediately into, you know, college seniors. They still picked up a couple of solid, you know, top 150-ish prospects, which is, you know, all you can really ask for when you're not really, you know, picking as much as anyone else. So, I mean, overall, I think it was a pretty solid haul. You know, they go after that, it was basically right back into, you know, college players. They went extremely college heavy, which is not surprising considering the Astros probably run, you know, most, if not all of their draft just off of models. So in terms of a team, you know, losing the first two picks, I would say this is pretty close to the best you would hope for a draft.
All right. And that rounds everything out. We've got some like interesting people not taken through round 10, but I feel like we've covered a lot. Is there anything you want to add before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's gonna be very interesting how this group shakes out, because they've lost, you know, some development time. So there might be some guys that we hear about just kind of blow up just because they didn't really get to play in 2020 and had potentially shortened years in 2021. So I think this is going to be a draft class that, you know, once it gets into pro ball, is kind of going to shake up maybe a little bit more than we expect. But, you know, overall it was a good draft. I mean, it's, you know, the draft wasn't like a, you know, blow you away type of, you know, some years, you know, like 2011 and stuff like that, where it just like you're finding all stars, you know, way deep into the first round. It might not end up being like that, but I think overall it was a, you know, pretty solid class. You know, draft's always fun going, you know, they're pairing it now with the All-Star game and the Futures game. And, you know, I could quibble about, you know, maybe they should have the draft on its own day with the Futures game, but I mean, overall, it was a lot of fun. It kind of helped, you know, build out a great week for MLB and really trying to, you know, provide some, you know, just some great content for everyone and to try and enjoy the game.
Yeah, and I definitely agree. I think that getting it out of that week of like super regionals and things for the college players, and like basically getting it to be less of a distraction during the playoffs, in terms of the college ranks, is super important. And I think that it, like you said, it adds a fun dynamic to All-Star Week if that's where they want to have it. Because, you know, Lord knows, you know, I'd rather distract a player in the middle of a Cape Cod League game than during, you know, Omaha. So, much different vibe. And I think that I think it's a good move to move it back like this. That's going to be it for us, I think, unless you've got anything else to add.
Nope. I think that's it. Thanks everyone for listening. You know, I hope you enjoyed the content. You know, there's a lot of teams, a lot of players, and I know you can probably read more into detail of, like, you know, scouting reports. You know, we hope it was kind of just a nice little, little taste of kind of what the draft was like. Thanks for stopping by.
All right, that's all we have for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, we'll be looking ahead to the trade deadline with potential moves, as well as enjoying some trade deadline trivia. Our Baseball Weekly is executive produced by Lewis and edited by me, Nine. Our production admin is Christine. I hosted the intro along with Martin, and Rob and Hack hosted our draft recap. Our theme music was composed by Chuck Lease. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.